Awesome, like podcasts and stuff?
I've seen people with podcasts less desperate for approval.
I hope this isn't about your podcast again.
Please, podcasts are verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Welcome to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
Hello, everybody. Episode number 54 of the Awful Announcing Podcast is here. This is the third Quarantined Inside edition of the AA Pod. I appreciate you guys stopping by and joining us. My name is Ben Heisler. If you are new to the show, I think you're in for a pretty good time today. Today's show is a little bit different than most of the ones that we've recorded in the past, and there's a distinct reason for that. Joe Buck, the voice of Fox Sports since 1996, is our guest. He has called 22 World Series, 6 Super Bowls, is part of the second longest running broadcast team to call NFL games since Pat Summerall and John Madden. And frankly, I don't think we talked for more than a few minutes about that whole list of accomplishments. And that's one hell of a list for a career and for a guy that's only 51 years old. And even as a young broadcaster, you know, a lot of us developed impressions and opinions of Joe, and he knows that we have. But over the last few years, he started to give off a bit of a different side, a laid-back, really funny, dry sense of humor. And he's really opened himself up. And the guy that you may think you know, you probably don't. And that's the type of conversation that we had on this episode of the Awful Announcing Podcast. And I'm really excited to share that conversation with you guys today. And so we'll get to that conversation with Joe coming up in just a minute. Couple quick announcements, though. This podcast is being released bright and early on Wednesday, April the 22nd. So for those that are listening on this very day, and then this will also be available later on as well. But later tonight, I will be hosting and moderating a first round NFL mock draft with just some incredible NFL writers, insiders, fantasy analysts, and sports betting writers. It's going to be at 8 p.m. Eastern time, and you can find all the info for this live stream. It's going to be a 32-person video conference. Everybody all at once. We're going to do it in 30 minutes or less. People are going to make a pick for their respective teams, take a shot, and move it forward. You can find all that information on my Twitter handle, at Benny Heiss. It's going to be a lot of fun. Just a couple of the names involved. You have Brad Evans, Diana Russini, Therese Paler, Adam Lefkoe, Liz Loza, Paul Charchi in the Hall of Famer, Mike Renner, Marcus Grant of NFL Network, Graham Barfield, Anita Marks. The list goes on and on, and I'd love for you guys to join us if you're looking for just a really fun, rapid-fire mock draft that involves a little bit of alcohol as well. You can always go to awfulannouncing.com. It's where all of our great content is available. And you can follow us on Twitter at awfulannouncing. If you want to follow me, you can do so at Benny Heiss. Of course, our guest Joe Buck is on Twitter at Buck, B-U-C-K. That is the letter B-U-C-K. And lastly, please rate and review the podcast over at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast from. I'm a bit of an Overcast fan. It's a great podcast app for me. It's super helpful, it's appreciated, and it truly helps find more people to come to the show. I first met Joe, and of course I'm talking about Joe Buck, when I was a senior at Indiana University in Bloomington in 2010. Came to give a speech. He went to IU up until he left to take the Cardinals job, I believe in 91, as a college senior, which is, again, pretty remarkable. Had a chance to interview him at the time, introduce him at the speaking engagement. And the dude couldn't have been more gracious with his time, kinder, helpful. And he was that same goofy, funny, personable guy that more and more people have only recently begun to see. And you might be listening to this saying, Ben, you're full of shit. Joe hates every team. He hates my team. He's only at this stage because his dad is famous. He's pompous. Whatever your preconceived notions might be. Here's what I want you to do. Listen to his new podcast with Oliver Hudson. It's called Daddy Issues, and they've done about a month's worth of episodes. They've had on Alex Rodriguez, Mark Cuban, Bill Simmons, and it's incredibly refreshing stuff, like really honest, raw conversation. And of course, I'll admit, it's fun to hear somebody as famous as Joe drop a bunch of F-bombs in just a very complete, organic fashion. So we get into all of that, him wanting to open up, more than he has ever in his previous years, the early years where he was trying to, you know, live up to his dad's reputation as a broadcaster, going through therapy, finding the positives, and becoming an open book. And there's also just some phenomenal stories along the way. So very excited to bring this conversation to you. The voice of Fox Sports since 1996. He's the one, the only, Joe Buck. I don't know if you remember this because you meet a lot of people along the way throughout your career, but I still feel very grateful having met you 10 years ago when you came to IU. I had a chance to interview you as part of IUS TV, and it seems crazy to think that this was 10 years ago. I'm grateful that you've kept in touch all these years. You occasionally check in, I'll shoot you a note, and it means a lot. So I'm really fortunate to have you on the show today.
Well, thanks. I mean, I think I learned from somebody that was really good at that. I'm not nearly as good as my dad was at kind of the interpersonal relationships that he maintained throughout the course of his life. I don't know what it was inside him that made him so thirsty to meet person after person after person. And then on top of that, remember them and little tidbits about their family history or their story or where they worked or whatever. But I did see the master at work. So I try to, and I think anybody that reaches out to me or anybody I meet who is starting out in this business is somebody that I feel, some sort of, I don't want to say guilt, but I feel some sort of, pull toward, because I know how lucky I was as a kid being able to go everywhere with my dad, being able to literally grow up in that broadcast booth and learn and just take in. And even when I wasn't paying that much attention, I was still gathering knowledge, and I was ready to broadcast the minor leagues at 19, and I was ready to do the Cardinals at 21, and that sped up everything. So I was ready for Fox at 24 and World Series at 27. It all went really fast, but I think it was the byproduct of having a Hall of Fame dad as a person, as a broadcaster, and then him wanting me around him as much as he did.
Everything did happen so fast, and things moved along over the course of your career. Have you, maybe on a personal level, been able to sort of allow that to slow down for yourself?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's, as you know now, there are two tracks. I mean, there are multiple tracks, but at least for me, two main ones, there's family and there's work. And then when, you know, you just added a child, I've added two more. I have two that are older. I'm 50, almost 51 years old. I mean, literally, what's the date? In like a week from today, I'm 51 years old. And I don't think of myself as 50. I still think of myself, oddly enough, as 28 or 30 years old. But while the family life is kind of sped up a little bit because of these twin boys, and it's been nothing but awesome, the work life, yeah, I think I've settled into a nice rhythm, even with the addition of Thursday Night Football. I think I've found a way to make it work in October, and the rest of the year I'm off. I mean, I'm not going year round. I'm not going week to week. I'm not working Monday through Friday. So I think the common perception is I'm never home. I'm never around my kids. And it's actually the opposite, because when I'm home, I'm home. I don't clock in anywhere in this world except on weekends when I go do games.
You talked about your two daughters, who I think they're in their early 20s, and now you have two young sons, twins. You said right around almost 2 years old or so.
Two, yeah.
Have you sort of been able to parent through this weird parallel universe where 20 something years ago you're going through this for the first time, and then all of a sudden, almost 20 years later, you're doing it again? I would imagine too, just over the course of that amount of time, probably your thoughts on parenting have changed, your thoughts on raising kids and the environment that they're in. Do you feel like you're kind of living in two different universes at all?
A little bit, but without speaking about somebody who can't, in this case, defend herself, I will just say that doing this with my wife, Michelle, has been really the biggest change. I don't look back and go, man, I wish I had put the time in. Man, I wish I was more excited when I was whatever I was, mid-20s, to have kids. Because now that I'm doing it at 50, you know, I see the opportunities I missed. I would guarantee you, and I've said this before, but I believe this, and my daughters have heard me say this on podcasts, including my own, that if you were sitting here talking to them, they would tell you I believe that their best friend is me. And that's from the time I put in when they were little. And again, going back, I don't have a 9-to-5. Other people have to make real sacrifices because of work. I did on the weekends, and yeah, I missed some stuff, and I missed games when they were playing them when they got older, and play dates on weekends. But I mean, I was immersed in it Monday through half of Friday. So I don't regret anything back then, 20 years ago or so. And it feels the same to me. It's just different getting to do it with Michelle and doing it with boys at this age. But the parenting part really feels very eerily similar.
I want to bring up something that you said too about your daughters feeling like you're their best friend, because that's something that you've talked about for a long time with you and your dad, that you considered him to be your best friend. And I just had a conversation with Ernie Johnson on this podcast before, and he had a similar opportunity in working alongside his dad in Atlanta. But I also talked to him about the apprehension of working with somebody who's been so well known and so beloved within the community for a long time. Do you remember ever having those type of thoughts when you had that dream opportunity to work alongside him? And how did you sort of balance all that?
Well, I think it was a lot. I look back and I'm proud of how I handled it when I got that job at such a young age. And let's be honest, I got it because I was Jack Buck's kid. If I was not Jack Buck's son, first of all, I wouldn't have been hired in Louisville. I wasn't the main guy in Louisville. A guy named Jim Kelch came there at the same time I showed up, and I was kind of the second fiddle to him. And then my dad got the CBS job kind of out of nowhere, doing CBS weekend baseball with Tim McCarver, oddly enough. And they needed somebody on a more regular basis to fill in with the Cardinals. And I'd done 2 years in the minor leagues. I left Indiana early, took the job here. And it went from I was just going to be a fill-in to the coordinating producer's like, just you do a piece of every game, and then you're there the second guy when your dad's gone on the weekends. It was like, great. I mean, there's no better way to start. But when I got hired, you know, there were articles when I was 20, turning 21, that it was offensive that I was hired strictly based on my last name. And reading that in my hometown newspaper, I cried like a baby when that came out. I remember where I was, and I was living in my mom and dad's house on top of all that. And then to sit in the booth with him and sit next to him was the greatest education. Forget all the stuff I said about being a kid, being on the air, calling him a partner, and then him not hovering over me. So, yeah, it was all good. It strengthened my relationship with him. I got a lot of the time back that I didn't have when he was traveling all over the place when I was a little kid. And he didn't like helicopter over me and say, well, I wouldn't have called that home run that way. Or
right.
I wouldn't have done that. Thank God, because had he been kind of this overbearing guy, like, let me tell you how I would do it, I probably would have rebelled against him, I think. And it might have soured me on the whole process before it really ever got going. So I'm so lucky to have had that time with him, and I enjoyed every minute of it. I was smart enough to know back then he wasn't going to be around forever.
Did you feel singled out kind of early on just because of the namesake? And listen, they're not going to bring you along if you can barely put a sentence together. It was still experience and enough experience for them to say, we feel comfortable putting you on the air. And yes, having an element of knowing your father played a role in it, but you still had to earn the job. But over the course of time, did you still kind of feel like you were getting singled out along the way?
Yeah, I think, Ben, when I look back, I say nepotism and I joke about it because it's the easy grab. But I guarantee you, unless I didn't know my dad at all, I guarantee you my dad never said, hire my kid.
Right.
No, there's just that for anybody that knew him, that was the furthest thing. And you know, even when I was starting at Fox and I would do, you know, big events in World Series, he downplayed everything with me. Now, was he this puppet master behind the curtain, like pulling these strings and having Anheuser-Busch hire me? I don't believe that. But did I feel singled out? That's how I kind of grew up in a really small town. I grew up in St. Louis. Everybody knew my dad. Therefore, everybody kind of knew my mom and knew me and knew my sister and knew my other brothers and sisters. And you always felt kind of singled out, especially at dinner with him. And I always was aware that if I screwed up as a kid, if I was caught or arrested or you know, got busted for drinking at a party or whatever. And I got hauled off to jail with five of my friends. It was going to be me and four others. And I knew that. So I've always kind of had eyes on me or been aware of that. And it was good training for how life is now. I mean, eyes are always on you. And I think more so now than ever. So I felt singled out, but I think that made me work hard. It was hard to swallow it at the beginning. The last thing I'm doing is complaining about it, because without all that, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. But I think that the positives far outweigh any of the negatives that are associated with me being my dad's son.
We've always heard a lot of stories about your relationship with you and your dad, but you still had your mom around, you still had your sisters around. What were they like, and sort of how did they define you as a guy growing up and turning into who you are now?
Yeah, not a lot of people ask me about my mom, but I would say that not only was my mom really the one who taught me, I mean, she taught me how to pitch. Her dad, Joe Linsnick, played for the Chicago Bears, played for George Halas, was on his all-time team as a punter, but he also played running back and linebacker. He was a great athlete. My mom was a really good athlete. Then she was on Broadway, and she could sing and dance and act. And so I get, even to this day, just as much constructive criticism from my mom. And even back then, I got more feedback from my mom than I ever did from my dad. I think, like any kid growing up in St. Louis that's my age or younger, you heard that style. And I took pieces of that style. But again, it was never like a tutorial with him at a chalkboard telling me how to call balls and strikes and home runs. So my mom, I think, was not only good for me in that regard, but was good for him. I don't think it's coincidental that Harry Carey had been fired at that point, right about the time I was born. But my mom was good for my dad too, made him think in different ways, was kind of his sounding board for banquet material, and was the kind of woman that could hold everything down while he was out, you know, sometimes for 2 weeks at a time before cell phones and, you know, earning checks. So my sister's great. She's on the air now. She works here in St. Louis. She went from my best fighting partner as a kid to probably my most trusted friend, other than my wife. So I'm lucky in that regard, and I'm lucky that they're still here with me, and I'm literally 10 minutes from both of them as I sit here talking to you right now.
There's something great about parental feedback too, and just raw, honest, they will tell you where you screwed up, how badly you did, and then at the end, they'll still try and bring you back on and say, but just remember, I love you, you're my son, you're going to do great the next time out, and somehow you end after you just got your ass kicked by your mom for 10 minutes, because that's happened to me. Plenty of different shows where she was going and saying, what the hell are you talking about her? I think you pretty much just made up a word, but I'm glad somebody told me. Sometimes feedback is key.
But I don't know how you are. When I would get it from my mom, and it was that way, and it was honest.
Oh, it took me a while to fully accept it.
It would make me mad. Yeah. And I'd be like, what are you talking about? No, I remember one time I was flip-flopping between the World Series and doing regular season football. I think this was right at the beginning, like 96 or 98, maybe somewhere in there. And I came back and I did a Rams game. And I called my mom and dad afterward. I always checked in after every game. My dad was just like, that was great, Buck. It was great. And then he hung up. And my mom was like, I don't know. For the first time, I thought you looked tired and you sounded like you didn't want to be there. And I was like, well, that's not right. Of course I want to be there. I want to do this. I mean, I'm dying to do these games. What are you talking about? And I got mad. And then as I started thinking about it and I went back and listened to it, I'm like, I am worn down. And I do sound like, you know, I don't have that life that I typically do. So, yeah, those are the opinions and the evaluations that are useful. I don't like the guys just like, yeah, man, that was awesome, you know, and then they move on to the night. That doesn't mean anything. And I take nothing from that. I'd rather get something that I can work on and get better at and be better the next time.
Are you able to still get feedback even at the highest levels besides dopes on Twitter saying that you're either the greatest thing or the worst thing? Are your bosses coming to you and saying, this is something that I really like, or people that you trust to say, hey, Joe, I heard something that I had a question about. Do you still get that at all, even at your level?
Not a ton, and I wish I got more. So up until last year, they stopped last year, our coordinating producer would have an outside source blindly evaluate our games. And it was so helpful to me. And it's so helpful to Troy. Now, again, sometimes you read things and you're like, oh, that's bullshit. I mean, it's easy for you to say sitting on the couch, but you don't know that while we were just about to go here, something changed in the game and made a shift and go another direction. It's a live event. The best laid plans, you know, you're thinking or you're trying to make some big point, and then all of a sudden it's irrelevant because something just shifted the whole storyline. Right. So, but that's the thing that's always bothered Troy about broadcasting. When he first got into it after, I don't know, year three or four, he's like, you know, the one thing that I still can't get my mind around is when I played, I had a quarterback coach, I had an offensive coordinator, I had a head coach, and I had a scoreboard. And between those four things, I knew at the end of the game if I was any good that day. And in broadcasting, like you say, I mean, it's so subjective, and it's evaluated these days, it seems like, mainly by people who are emotional and emotionally invested in the game. And I get all that. And you and I have talked about it, and I can talk about it till I'm blue in the face and do seminars on it. It's totally different doing a national broadcast compared to a local broadcast, even from the way it's directed by the same guy that can do a Cardinal package and then do a Fox package, an entirely different job. So when that's the majority of your feedback, it's just like, what am I doing? Or you start questioning yourself. So I didn't like that those evaluations stopped. And you can do a Super Bowl for 100 million people and you get to the truck compound afterward, or you go to the bar and you see all the bosses and whatever, and you know, they'll give you a little pat on the back, but there's no like, you know, here's what I loved. This was good. This was good. This wasn't so good. This was good. You just want feedback from somebody whose opinion matters.
I'm glad you brought that up too, just because in a lot of these conversations, even at the top level, and so many people think, well, they've made it to the top level, they don't need the type of feedback that maybe a lot of us, when we're starting out or when we've been doing this for a couple of years, to hopefully reach to that pinnacle point. I think it's awesome that you want more coaching, even over the course of this.
Well, I think you could make the case that if you're the whatever to Eric Shanks at Fox, ultimately he tells me what he thinks of my performance by what he pays me and by the jobs I keep, you know, I hang on to. If he didn't like it, there's literally 100,000 people lined up to do it. And I assume that those 100,000 people, while their faces and names have changed over the years, it's the same length line that started in 96 when I was doing the World Series. It just depends on if they find the right person that they like better. So he could always fall back on that. And I'm not blaming Eric, because Eric's one of my best friends, certainly in this business, but maybe in life, because he's a guy that's self-made and started as a runner, basically, for Fox. And now he's our boss. Thank God he's cool and he's not tightly wound and whatever. He's just kind of like, do your job and all's good. I think it's at a lower level that you want to hear a little bit more feedback. But you're right. I mean, I think it's the biggest stumbling block, and it's what's astounded me about Tony Romo. Not to totally shift, but I think it's valuable here, because there have been a lot of analysts that have come into this business and they say, well, this guy, take Joe Montana, one of the best players in the history of the game, smart, good-looking guy, can talk. He'll be the best analyst. I mean, it's Joe Montana. He'll be the best, and it just wasn't for him. But I guarantee you he didn't get the kind of shaping that he required or needed when he got into this business. I think a lot of times people just expect you to understand what they want from you, and the direction is just really not all that crystal clear. So everybody's trying to cover their own ass, but there needs to be, I think, a little bit more help for some of these people getting into the business. And as they rise through the ranks, that help has got to continue, because you just want a legit sounding board to tell you what's good and where you need to get better.
Who do you think is the next Romo amidst all the conversations that you've had with current players, with former players, with guys that you think just get it? Do you see somebody on the horizon for who might be next?
I mean, it should be Peyton Manning, but for the most obvious reasons of all time. I mean, he can host SNL. He does funny commercials. He delivers lines. He kind of seems like he gets it. And what? But I don't think he wants to do it. And B, you've got to hear somebody do it before you can say, okay, that style fits what people are looking for in a game. I mean, I think Drew Brees would be a layup. I think Philip Rivers would kind of be really cool because he's always been a great interview. He's always been self-deprecating. He's always been honest. I think that's the thing that, you know, what's great about Tony and what I try to get out of Troy is a laugh. And what's made Terry Bradshaw millions of dollars is the ability to genuinely laugh at himself. Like if he screws something up royally on the Fox pregame, that turns into the best minutes of the entire hour. Because right. He will belly laugh at himself. And you can give him trouble about whatever it is, divorces or, you know, oh, you're not the, you know, sharpest tack in the box or whatever. He will laugh at that. And that's what I've tried to tell anybody getting into it. And what I've come around to all these many years later is you better be willing to laugh at yourself and not take yourself too seriously. Or the pressure of some of these assignments in this business will just run you right out of it.
It's a perfect transition because there's nobody that's been laughing more at himself than you over the course of Daddy Issues. You guys are four episodes in, three really good guests, which I'll get to in a second. But I'm glad you brought that up. And that was even something that you discussed with Bill Simmons, too. And you told him how much you admired his ability to just authentically be himself in really any situation, whether it's just talking with somebody on the street or doing NBA Countdown or all the different work through his podcast that he's doing. And you talked about that revelation for yourself as well. Was it writing the book? Was it, you talked about different therapy that you've gone through. When did you feel like I need to be able to do this for myself to feel better moving forward?
Yeah, I think it was a few things. Well, it's probably more than a few, but I've been at this a long time now. And it's, I used to feel like the kid in the room, and now that doesn't apply anymore. I've been doing it at Fox for whatever it is, 27 years or whatever the number is. So that doesn't really work. I think it was going through my vocal issue from the hair plugs, which led to the book, which I really, that thing crystallized for me right at the time when I met you. Because I remember running into Michael Rosenberg at the World Series in Kansas City. So after I met you, but shortly thereafter in Kansas City, and we were in line, like getting something to drink in the press lunchroom or whatever. And I said, I started to write a book, and he had done a thing on me for Sports Illustrated. He said, oh, send it to me. And that started the process of him kind of molding and shaping the book. And like I said to the publisher, when we sold the thing, I said, you know, you probably don't want me saying this, but I don't care if this book sells one copy or 1 billion copies. I just want to write it. I feel like everybody's got an opinion of me. And I have not read one opinion of me that's right. At least how I see myself.
Yeah.
People don't know me. And so once I went through the vocal issue, wrote the book, you know, I've been at this a long enough time. I feel like if I'm going to open up and be me, I'm just going to open up and be me. A lot of people already don't like me for whatever reason. If they think I don't like their team or I'm, you know, you emote too much, you don't emote enough, whatever it is, I might as well let them know the real me and then really evaluate me. But the frustrating thing is you go, man, I feel like I'm doing a decent job. I have never gone into a World Series rooting against or for one team over the other. I just don't care. Even when it comes to St. Louis, people in St. Louis think I hate the Cardinals or I'm rooting against them, and it's just nuts. But you have to be excited for both sides. We've covered that. But that's kind of, I'm like, all right, if people already have formed an opinion, let's give them who I really am and give them information to inform them for making their opinion instead of what they're figuring out between ball one and strike two.
But that's still not an easy thing to do, Joe. If you've already felt like you've had to be one way for a long time and be very protective, especially considering everything that you heard from a very young age as you were growing through Fox, as you were doing the initial Cardinals broadcast, like you were very protective of yourself for a long time. So then several years, 20 something years later, to be able to let that go, I imagine it was tough, but it was also probably gratifying at the same time.
it's really liberating, and it's it is gratifying. You know, I almost on another, as another example of it, I look at Phil Mickelson, you know, and what he's doing on social media. And on one hand, it's like, what the hell am I looking at? You know, like, this is not the Phil Mickelson
right.
that I've seen from a distance, or this is not, you know, you get, and that's what I got from that DirecTV show I did. You know, you think you know who these athletes are, or these world champions, or these Hall of Famers, and man, everybody's been through stuff in their life, and everybody's been down on their knees hoping for a break, or hoping that something will change, or been rattled to their core by something in their family, or failed on a big stage, or whatever it is. And, you know, we're all kind of the same along those lines. And I was like, I just want to be my authentic self. And it's been probably the most fun, I don't know, 3 years of my career. And you know, I think a lot of that's being happy with being who I'm married to and the fun we have. And now these boys, and combining them with my daughters and seeing that love grow. And it's been a nice little 3 year run here along those lines.
I would think too, that the feedback that you've probably been getting since that opportunity where you felt you could probably really open up has had to be fascinating too. People to see you in a different light, like even on your Twitter bio, I think it says, you think you know me, but you don't. You
yeah.
probably, it's something along those lines. And now we're living in a society too, Joe, where Twitter, Instagram, people are showcasing what appears to be this perfect life. We don't have that, but we're showcasing our best self. Maybe in reality, we should be showcasing our real self.
Well, man, I mean, as I'm now firmly entrenched as a middle-aged man, I could not agree more. And I see it with my daughters, you know, and I see these Instagram posts that I'm probably guilty of to some degree too, where you try to paint everything. You know, you take out some of the wrinkles in your face, you make your eyes a little whiter, you auto tune or whatever you call it, all these pictures. And it's like, man, that is nobody's real life. That isn't how people are. People are, especially now, people are scared, and people are flawed, and people are, you know, sometimes dragging ass out of bed in the morning, or tired, just constantly tired, or going through therapy, or on antidepressants, or just find, when's the next check going to come? I mean, my God, how many people are in this country right now going, what's next? How am I going to make rent? How am I going to, and that's, you know, that's the real stuff. So, I don't know. Social media and I have been not great friends over the years, but over the last month and a half, when I started doing those quarantine calls or whatever, people's videos from their homes. And I think it allows me to show my own personality with those calls and be funny and be light and whatever. The tides turned a little bit. And then I think you have to kind of springboard off that and just keep hammering that home that, you know, again, you think you know me, but you don't.
By the way, one of those first videos that you ended up publishing for Fox, the homemade videos, that was my buddy Tom, the guy with the darts from off to the side. That's a guy that I've known
oh
for
God.
A handful of years in KC.
I mean, that of all the ones that I did, I mean, it just looked like he's throwing some sort of knuckleball dart that is darting. I mean, literally darting all over the place and comes sideways and hits a bullseye. It was amazing.
Steve Sparks of Kansas City, just hanging out in the backside, just
exactly, yeah,
figuring it out. I'd love to talk about the podcast with you, because I feel like this really is a good transition, because I don't think this podcast happens, even with your friendship with Oliver and with his family, unless you sort of have this breakthrough of feeling like you can truly be your authentic self. And the results too from the show, Joe, are tangible. Like, I feel like the sort of the elevator pitch for the show is you guys are laid back, you go with the flow, but the objective is talk about your life, talk about parenting, being dads, dealing with your own fathers openly, freely, but you're also busting each other's balls and you guys are trying to laugh your ass off along the way.
Yeah, and he and I are just a weird mix. I mean, he's 7 years younger than me. He's LA all the way. Let's say he lives a little bit more carefree lifestyle, however you want to interpret that. And like I said, I mean, I'm wound pretty tight, and it's taken a lot of work to get me to this point, at least publicly. That's what we're all talking about, publicly, not privately, or right. When I'm with friends playing golf, or if, you know, whatever, we're sitting around the house. So, he's got a million daddy issues, and he wants to talk about them, and he's worked a lot on himself, and I'm living in my dad's shadow, if nowhere else other than my mind. But certainly to people in St. Louis, which is where I still live, people of a certain age will always look at me as A, Jack Buck's son, B, not as good, C, somebody who's turned his back on the Cardinals because there was excitement in his voice when Travis Ishikawa hit a game-winning home run in the LCS against him. So screw you, Buck, your dad's turning over in his grave. And A, they didn't know my dad, and B, he was the opposite of that. But and then, you know, for Ollie, he's got sister Kate. He's got his brother Wyatt Russell, who's kind of hit it big here lately. He's got Kurt Russell, who's basically his dad. And he's got Goldie Hawn as his mom. And he finds himself in this mix as being somebody that hasn't measured up to the other success stories in his own family. Yet I'm friends with all these other people individually, started with Kate, and they all admire Oliver and his sense of humor and his timing and his acting ability, probably more than their own. But Oliver doesn't see any of that, and he thinks that he's a failure. So we're two oddly paired people that are willing to talk about anything. Our wives are friends. It's just a good mix. So we've had fun.
And the stories that you guys have told about parenting, and again, this is from my own perspective of being a first-time dad with an 11-month-old. I don't want to give it away because it's a great story that Oliver told about his stepdad, Kirk. And they went hiking in the woods when he was about 5 or 6. And again, I don't want to give it away, but everything from the underlying component of parenting to figuring out shit on your own and key life lessons. Like, again, I feel like sometimes you can be living in two different minds, and to go back and forth on that the way that you guys have, to really open up and see it from all these different perspectives, I think a lot of people have really latched onto it.
Yeah, I just think they're at least, and I've never been a huge podcast guy, but I think that there's been a hole there a little bit, even though there are literally 700,000 podcasts out there, and some of them are obviously fantastic and great listens. I usually, if I'm in transit, I'm reading or I'm trying to catch up, but I think that there's been a hole there for people of, you know, all different ages who are trying to father, not parent, not be the mom, but father. Now, are there experts out there that can give you psychological explanations for everything, and psychiatrists and medication and all that? We're not experts. We're just trying to find our own way as dads. And I've read plenty of self-help books and dad books, and I get about a third of the way through a dad book, and I'm like, I don't believe one word this guy's saying. I would not raise my kid the way this guy, and then it's gone. And so we try to do it in a fun way. And you're right, you know, with that story with regard to Oliver, I think that's been his highlight so far, talking about Kurt, you know, and in essence, having him find his own way home. And then me saying that it's been hard for me to not try to make everything perfect for my 23-year-old who's been in New York, now in St. Louis, my 20-year-old who's at USC. I mean, you just want to swoop in and make everything right. And that's you're not doing them a service by doing that. That's your instinct.
Right.
Sometimes you have to let them find their own way, which, believe it or not, my dad let me most of the time just kind of find my own way.
I also love the first three guests that you guys have brought on. I haven't had a chance to hear the full A-Rod conversation yet, but Bill Simmons was the first guest. You had Mark Cuban on, then A-Rod. The connection that I discovered between those three, well, all of them are rich as shit. So that's
right.
that's a good way to start off. But in all seriousness, they're all guests who have a lot of people who love them and a lot of people who also can't stand them. But collectively, over the course of the show, they've been an open book. And I feel like they really kind of followed your guys' lead through that. Was that difficult at all? I know that you're friends with A-Rod, but that's a guy that's, as of late, what a colossal turnaround in his own career to now be able to be at the top of his profession and openly talking about a lot of the key mistakes that he's made. It's pretty remarkable.
It's stunning. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, 2014, he was suspended for the year. He was suing baseball. And now he's in essence the main baseball voice on ESPN analyst-wise, and he's on our pregame on Fox and all over the place, and J-Lo and Page Six and Shark Tank. And, you know, I think the best thing about that episode is that he's real when he's talking about his dad, and he's real when he's talking about his daughters. And it's a side of him. I think he's been really protective because of the steroids, because of, you know, the suspension, everything. He's like, you know, hey, it's at least I'm the longest to ever be suspended. there's some truth to that too, but he was genuine and authentic. And I think, you know, for even Bill Simmons, who I don't know that well, I've been on his podcast. I think I've done his twice, and he used to rip the hell out of me because he didn't like me calling Boston games. We talked about that at the beginning of it, but we share a publicist, Lewis Kay. That's how I got to Bill. And Lewis, after listening to the interview, was like, man, there were things that I learned about Bill that I never knew. And that's like the greatest compliment that I can be paid, or we can be paid, because he's been with Bill forever. So I think if you go into it and you pitch A-Rod that you're going to talk about family and blended families and his own father, and, you know, you got to be willing to talk about it. But it's not the same old stuff where it's like, hey, tell us about 2009 when you finally won the World Series. Right. I mean, I could not care less about any of that. And, you know, that's for other shows. And I think people are liking that.
Any new issues that you guys want to be able to tackle on in the next upcoming episodes?
Yeah, I think we want to have a little bit more structure at the top. I think we want to kind of, we're still going to freewheel, but I think we, you know, when we get on it, we don't plan anything. And I think sometimes that's good. Sometimes we need a little bit of planning. So we're going to do a little bit more and write down things during the week. And I think it'll be a little bit more revealing about us and what we have going on in our lives and how we grew up. And then the guests, I mean, yeah, we've got, let's see, David Spade is coming up. We've got Joel McHale coming up. We've got Kelly Slater coming up. We've got, I don't know. There's a handful of people lined up right behind them. Adam Levine, we are strong arming into coming on. And I think, again, if you get these guys on, Vetter wants to come on. At least he says he will. I'm trying to go through Vetter to get Springsteen. We'll see. I've gotten in trouble doing that before, but I think Eddie's cool enough that that he will help link us up. So we'll see.
As a longtime radio producer, you do what you have to do, whether it's calls through one guy to another. Like, this is that life.
I did that. I'll just tell you a quick story. I don't think I've ever told this story. Back years ago when the Yankees and Red Sox were rolling, and it was the whole start of that thing. It was like the mid 90s on. We started in 96. So I would say this was probably, I don't know, maybe 2002, three, somewhere in there. We're doing the postseason, and our producer, Mike Weissman, who was great, he's like, well, we got these, you know, these T-Mobile trivia questions, and you're just reading them. And then we wait a little while, and then you answer them. We got celebrities hanging off the walls here at Yankee Stadium. Why don't we have a celebrity read the question and try to answer it live on the air? I was like, man, that's awesome. That's right up my alley. So a couple booths over was Billy Crystal, who I had done some stuff for with that movie he did, 61.
Yeah.
I revoiced some stuff. So this was long enough after 98 so I'm just going to say it's 03. And, I go in there and I'm like, hey, Billy, you know, we're doing these questions and we're going to have celebrities answer. I'm like, oh, yeah, great. I said, would you mind asking Robin Williams if he'll come on and do the question? And it was like I asked him, I'm not even going to fill in what just ran through my mind, but it was like the biggest insult. He's like, oh, so I'm not good. You want me to go be your agent and try to get Robin Williams? I said, I'm like, well, kinda, yeah. And Robin did it, and then Billy was there and like chiming That's in, crazy. And I knew Billy was pissed off when he was doing it. But I got to talk to Robin Williams at least once in my life. It happened to be on national TV from two booths away, but he did it.
That's fantastic. And again, you wouldn't have known if you didn't take that chance either. So,
and then I pissed off Billy Crystal. I think we've talked ever since.
Maybe this is an opportunity. Get him on Daddy Issues.
Come back to me.
I think that's perfectly fair. I know you got to run in a couple minutes. I just have a couple more for you, if that's all right. One of my favorite stories that I got a chance to hear you tell was, I think, right around the time that Lucky Bastard came out. And I'm wondering, have you had a pot brownie since that infamous night in Cabo?
I'm so bad on any drug. I mean, the only thing I've tried, I don't know why I said that. The only thing I've ever tried is pot. I'm such a little baby about all this stuff. And yeah, I was going through a divorce in 2011, never smoked weed, never eaten weed. I never got that whole thing. It was my badge of honor that I'd always stayed away from it, even though it was all around me in high school and college. And I went to this little prep school in St. Louis, and believe me, pot was nothing compared to what kids with money were doing back in the late 80s. So I was just like so proud that I could stand off in the distance and just watch it and not do it. So I go down to Cabo in 2011, going through the divorce. My voice was a mess. I thought my career was over. I'm like, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to, you know, probably didn't even say it right. Like, I'm going to eat pot or something. And I was playing golf all day with my friends down there. And then at the dinner party that I went to that night or somebody's house, they're like, oh, yeah, we got these pot brownies. I'm like, I talked to my friend who's the GM down there. And I'm like, well, what do you think? He's like, I said, I just need to relax. I need to relax. I need my voice to come back. I need to. So he breaks this thing off in two, and I eat a half, and he eats a half, and 45 minutes goes by. I'm like, of course me. I can't even be high. I can't relax. He's like, well, I mean, we could eat more. I'm like, all right. So we break off another chunk. And then, you know, the rest of the story, anybody who's done that, we're like, oh, well, let's go downtown to the bar or whatever, the Nowhere Bar, great bar. We go down there, and about halfway down, I'm trying to text somebody, and the letters and numbers are flying in my face. And I ended up, I said to the guy I was with down there, I'm like, look, man, we got to go. I can't feel my legs. And I don't even know how I'm going to walk from here to the exit from the bar. And he's like, yeah, we'll go in a second. I'm like, no, we got to go now. And we get up, and it's in this marina. And I thought we were going to go one way, legitimately. And he thought we were going to go around the people because it was packed. And he pulled me one way, and I, like, my head spun around, and I passed out. And my head went under the rope. I almost went into the water. And, like, I had a dream on my way down. I was probably on the ground for 0.08 seconds. I don't think anybody saw it except for the security guy who picked me up. And I was like, oh, my God, everybody knows. Everybody, I was stone cold sober from that instant forward. And I was like, it's not good for me.
So I said, so that was it. That was one and done from that point
forward.
Yeah,
it's just, I think that's part of why I admire, let's say, Oliver so much. I just don't have the ability to not be in control. And maybe and not that you're totally out of control, but I don't like not feeling like I'm 100% myself. And I think it comes from what you asked me earlier, feeling like eyes are on me, or growing up as a kid, always knowing that, you know, somebody's checking you out. Or it's why I don't dance at weddings, because I feel like everybody's going to watch me to see if I can dance or if I suck, which I do suck.
We all do, though. All of us are terrible dancers.
But many people can dance at a wedding in anonymity and suck, and nobody cares.
That's fair.
But if I go out there and I'm like all over the place, you know, it's like a Seinfeld episode, and I feel like they're going to wake up the next day, and all they're going to remember is Joe Buck is like a moronic dancer.
That's great. Well, I hope at some point you feel a little bit more comfortable.
No, I won't. And my wife was a Broncos cheerleader for, I don't know, 7 years, and is dying to go to like hip hop classes and all that. I'm like, you married the wrong guy, because that will never change.
Last thing I have for you, and you've been awesome with your time, it's always good to catch up with you. Being around your dad for all those years, especially being able to travel at a young age and getting a chance to meet some of his friends and bigwigs in the business, I love hearing old time, like broadcasters, famous people going out drinking stories. And I'm wondering if you have a great Jackbox story. Like I'm thinking about the one with Harry Callis, where he's out with a bunch of broadcasters late one night, and they're out at some bar. It's like 1 a.m. And I hope the story is true, because the answer that he gave is too good for it not to be. A lady of the night comes by their table, and she says, "Hey boys, for $200, I'll do whatever you want. Whatever you want for $200. And Harry Callis turns to her and says, "Well, sweetheart, how about doing the pregame show?"
I guarantee you that's true.
Okay, good.
I mean, those guys, Harry Callis, certainly Harry Carey.
Oh, yeah.
Bob Prince was somebody, I mean, he did the Pirates forever. He was probably my dad's favorite person just because he made my dad laugh. Euchre's unbelievable.
Oh, yeah.
And to this day is just one of the all-time great humans and legit one of the funniest people to this day. His timing is so quick. He's amazing. And I love the guy, and he loved my dad. And so I had an early in with him, and I just cherish him. Those guys, I feel like they could kind of live their lives, and they showed up on air and they showed up hungover, and they just slugged through the broadcast and then went and did it again. And, when I was selling my book and promoting it, I talked about some of the things my dad said, put a couple of lines in that my dad said on the radio. And, let's just say they weren't politically correct. And nobody really cared. And somebody in New York was interviewing me as a reviewer and said, you say in this book, that it was different back then. Are you saying that it was better? And I said, well, no, I'm not saying it was better. I'm saying it was different. And they're like, misogynist statements or something that borders on. I said, no, don't try to paint me into a corner here. I'm not saying it was better. I'm just saying that I don't think my dad showed up until his last bit of his career, when he got the number one CBS TV baseball job, and it did not go well. Yeah, a 2-year deal and a 2-year option, and he was done after 2 years. It just wasn't a fit for him, and he got a lot of criticism, and it ate him alive. But prior to that, like around the Cardinals, he just lived his life, and that was him. I don't think he was – so when we talk about all this stuff of me, being my authentic self and all that, I think that was my dad, really his entire career. And it was just a different time in this country. It was a different time on the radio. It was – so all those stories, those guys ran hard and those guys had a blast. I just think about a game that my dad did in Green Bay with Pat Summerall. I think Tom Brookshire was there, and this may have happened after the original Ice Bowl. They chartered a plane. My dad never had a ton of money, so I can't imagine where they got the plane. But they chartered a plane to fly them from Green Bay back to Chicago, I think, after the game, because they either wanted to go out or they wanted to get on an airplane and go to their various home cities. And as they are taking off and drinking, the door flies open and the airplane, they ended up ditching it. The guy ditched it in a field after the Ice Bowl, I believe, but definitely a game that they did in Green Bay. And they got out of it laughing about it. I would never get on a plane again in my life. But, those guys, I said it early in my book, and he wrote about it early in his book, that let's just say whatever was warming them up when they were broadcasting the Ice Bowl was not just coffee. And I think that was a little bit more passable back then, and not so much now.
Joe, it's great to catch up. Thanks for being a part of the show. Thanks for being a friend for all these years. And best of luck with everything going on with the podcast, with your family, with your two beautiful kids. Your four beautiful kids, I should say. Always enjoy catching up.
I struggled with part two. I'm like, yeah, I'm a dad to two. I mean, four kids. I'm like, four kids? Well, how the hell did that happen?
It's good to catch up. Thank you again, man. This was a lot of fun.
All right, buddy. Yeah, proud of you. Keep doing great work. Good to talk to you, Ben.